Hello everyone, today we have another special guest, Henry. He suffered from addiction, drug dealing and an accidental stabbing with a pencil. It sounds funny, but you know, genuine feelings come from that. Just means that any weapon can be used. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Good.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to the start, so let's go for it.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Henry. I'm a recovering drug addict. I am just coming up to 3 years clean and sober.
Well done, mate.
So, yeah. And, yeah, at the beginning, you know, it was I got bullied in school, and that was sort of why I turned to drugs.
Yeah, you're going from that, yeah? Like, you say that the first experience for you taking drugs was from being bullied within school. Did you go to a normal school? Was it a boarding school?
Went to a private school.
Private school.
So, yeah, down the road. And, yeah, it's no different there. Kids are still kids.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was just a way to escape. It's that sort of classic escapism.
Was it a mixed school?
Yeah.
A mixed school, yeah? Yeah, so was it the boys that were just bullying, or was it girls as well?
Sort of everyone. I was an overweight, short, like 12-year-old, so it was sort of, yeah, easy target.
So it was mainly bullying words through visual aspect, yeah?
Yeah.
What kind of things that put you to the point where drugs was your answer?
I found sort of alcohol and cigarettes in my last sort of year and got a fake ID, and then that was that escape.
The fake ID?
Mr. Yeah.
McLovin?
No, Edward Cullen. More tragic. it was that sort of alcohol was that first thing that sort of just gave me that escapism. And then someone turned around to me and said, if you start selling drugs, they'll stop bullying you. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool, sign me up.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that an elder or was that someone within your
No, it was an elder guy outside of the school as well.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was sort of like, I just sort of jumped at it. I was like, yeah, all right, yeah, cool.
So this was elders coming into your school, or was this break times?
At an after party at sort of like, you know, on a Friday night at someone's house.
Yeah.
It was sort of this local drug dealer who someone knew, and he used to come in. And then, yeah, I managed to, I was sort of a slightly more confident with stuff like that. So I was like, yeah, I'll buy drugs for everyone. As a sort of overweight, asthmatic person that was like, I'm never going to touch them. No, I'm never going to smoke it. I'm asthmatic. And then, I was already smoking cigarettes and stuff like that. So, yeah, he sort of was like, you can do this for me. And I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, cool. It was another thing that would stop, like, get people off my back and give me another escape, really.
What did your parents make of the bullying and stuff? Like, what kind of background have you got there? Your parents together, working class?
Yeah, sort of upper middle class. But it was sort of, all the bullying just sort of got swept under the rug. Nothing ever happened of it.
Ignore it, it'll go away.
Yeah, I stopped telling people. You know, I was depressed when I was about 14, and it was just that if I don't talk about it, then I don't have to, like, do anything about it. So I just used to...
Don't talk about the depression then, you mean?
Don't talk about the bullying, don't let anyone know what's going on, and then I don't get any more, sort of, like, any more attention.
Did you get bullied after the depression, or did you get depression because of bullying?
It was all sort of hand in hand. It was all about the same sort of time. I suffer with mental illness now called borderline personality disorder, and it all sort of manifests at that sort of young age. That's sort of when it started. And it was all, I'd always been sort of fat growing up, so it was always that sort of, like, people always made jokes, and then sort of when we got a bit older, it started to affect me more.
Yeah.
So it was, I just sort of ignored it and just kept ignoring it.
Why did you find that it started affecting you more the older you got?
I don't know, the more sort of self-conscious. You know, I'm a little bit older than some people, so the internet was coming around. You know, I still remember when you had to put in an age to be able to sign up to MySpace.
Oh, wow, MySpace. Talking.
And it was that whole sort of aspect of life, that seeing people online, seeing people in the media, and that sort of... I started to get told that I was overweight, especially the more in school it was that you started doing things to test your physical ability and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So was it just the kids that were saying that you was overweight, or did you get grief from the elders as well?
Didn't really get grief. There was a load of like six formers that used to like sort of jump on and stuff like that, and it was sort of a joke. I mean, my nickname was Squishy in school.
Okay,
and that was where it all came from, that squish, and it was them taking the piss out of me because I was fat.
Right, I can see why, like, because I knew when I first met you, I knew you as Squish.
Yeah.
I can see why you'll step away from it now. Now, obviously, I call you Henry.
Yeah.
But, I can see now why you're stepping away from it. I didn't know that then.
Yeah. And it was all because it came kind of ironic, because I found drugs and then found Class A's and then lost a shit ton of weight really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was like, I just keep being called Squish because now I'm not Squishy.
Yeah, yeah. So going back to the elder, the drug dealer that was offering you rite of passage to be accepted in society amongst all of the other elders for you to be liked and to feel better about yourself.
Yeah.
And he'd seen that you suffered with a form of depression. So he did you feel like he used that to enter into, get you to manipulate you into doing what he wanted you to do?
I'd like to say no, but he might have. It was that, you know, it was a nice guy. He was once giving me a lift when I was like, I think I was in my 20s, and he gave me a lift home from clubbing.
You're making him money though, right?
Yeah, and he was a nice guy, but that was sort of it, you know. I had a motorbike when I was 16, so, you know, I had transport and stuff like that. And as much as I'd like to go, yeah, he was helping me out, you know, he was getting me to sell drugs for him, so.
Yeah. So, like, some would say, especially from the outwards view in, that is definitely a form of grooming.
Yeah.
You to create friendships that's not real.
Yeah.
To be able to sink you into the life of doing something that he wouldn't do.
Yeah.
So he can gain capital gain.
Yeah.
And you were doing it for your notoriety more than money, because you come from an upper middle class. Say upper middle class. Yeah, that's far from me. That is like
that's quite far from me now.
So, how did you obtain these drugs? Did you have your own money to be able to buy these? Did you have an income from your parents, or was this all tipped and then you?
No, it was just all tipped. Everything was tipped, and then I'd get rid of. At first, it started out as if you move this much, you can have this much, and then it all sort of got up to like, yeah, you can tick an ounce for a week, and then just kept going from there. And then I met new people, and, you know, it all just carried on. You know, it was all just tick all the time.
So when you say an ounce, what was you talking, just for people that
So yeah, an ounce is about this much. In like weight and
no, an ounce of what?
Oh, so an ounce of it started off as an ounce of weed.
Yeah.
And then it sort of progressed on from there, where I got introduced by new people to new drugs. And then being an addict, I'd try them and go, I need that in my life. So I'm going to do this as well as doing everything else.
Was you already addicted before was your addiction just drugs and drink, or was it other things, you know, before the harder stuff?
And yeah, I mean, it was, you know, addicted to Kit Kats, addicted to, you know,
so you got anything. Addicted personality.
Yeah, it just, and that was it. If it changed the way I felt, then I'd carry on doing it.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So it was, as soon as Class A's come on the scene, you know, the really awesome life changers that sort of really do change your whole feeling and stuff like that, it was like, I need all of these in my life.
I think with alcohol, I think everyone, especially from as young as they can get it, definitely tried alcohol and pushed themselves, you know, to the limits with alcohol to the point of like laying on the park floor and all of the above. It's just standard stuff of things. So
I was that person that would do that and then go, this is my limit, and then go, okay, I'm going to go up to that limit every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was...
Your addiction allowed you to just drink at night time, or was this an all day thing?
No, it was like I remember it's that I would be thinking about it all week, like, when's Friday going to get here?
Okay.
And then it was, and then we go on a couple more weeks, and I'm going, it's nearly Friday, I can have a drink today, you know, on my own in my bedroom.
Oh.
And then it's, now I can take a little bit of alcohol in school, and then, you know, have a little bit at lunchtime and stuff like that. So
it really progressed. Like, what was the progression time? Was it?
Oh, you know, a couple of months.
And it really?
Was that, I always say, as soon as I picked up drugs, you know, I used as an addict the whole time. I never had that.
That's what I'm saying. With the alcohol, you were already well addicted.
Yeah,
so as soon as you tried something that give you that little bit more, that was like on it.
As soon as I tried weed, I was like, I need this every day for the rest of my life. And then, you know, working up, you know, you've got speed, you've got coke, you've got E, you've got MDMA and stuff like that. Every time I tried it, I was like, I need as much of this as possible, and I'd add it into everything else as well.
Mm.
You know, and then it was, I just needed to keep changing the way I felt, because as soon as it stopped working as well, I need more of it, or I need something different as well as it.
Mm.
So yeah, it was.
To sort of the point where you can't function your day without like starting it off.
Yeah.
With
narcotics. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was that always, I needed them to feel normal. It was that I used to take so much of everything, and I know exactly how it all worked in me, all my uppers, all my downers, and I tried to balance it all out perfectly, so it's just a solid straight line.
Was this something you had to learn along the way, or was this something that you'd been taught?
It was sort of something that I learned along the way, and seeing how things affected my body, and then go, oh, okay. So.
Because you were taking them, or because you'd see other people taking them?
A bit of both. Like watching someone on coke for the first time, I remember being like, I don't want to stay up all night, so how do I counteract this?
Yeah.
And it was always that, I was always trying to be really crafty with it, and it's like, I won't have a problem if I can go to sleep at the end of the night, so now I need a load of Valium to take at the end of the night so that I can get my head down on the pillow, and then that means I'm not an addict.
What age are we talking at? You started taking hard drugs.
I started taking speed when I was about 17. Someone just gave me a handful of it and said, eat it, and I was like, okay. You know, no questions, no what is it, no anything like that. It's just like, yeah, fine. And then started doing tremadols and stuff like that at about 17. And always had someone going, you can't have too many because you're not over 18. No. And you know, because age really makes it.
Can I see your idea? Yeah, sure.
You can only have three because you're under 18. Yeah. It's like, and then, you know, I started doing coke, I think it was on my, like, just before my 18th birthday. And then, you know, it just all progressed on. At that sort of speed, you know, just as soon as someone said, oh, I've got some MDMA, I was like 19, I was like, cool, let me have a little. And they're like, no, we only do a little bit. And I was like, I'm doing that whole bag by the end of the night, so let me do it all now. And really? that was my mentality, you know, it was that I will do it all, so you may as well just give it all to me.
Wow. Yeah, that's insane. So along this path of you doing these drugs, from drinking right away through your class aids, especially with the amount that you're saying to it, did any of your family, like your mum and dad, they spot it? Did they try and like challenge you on this?
No, not really. I just sort of kept to myself, you know. I left school and then I just worked, sort of went off. And then it was that same, I guess I sort of carried around that same, I used to keep to myself when I was young because of the bullying. So yeah, I just sort of went off and that was it. You know, I just existed, I guess they thought, just on my own.
Do you think that helped with you and pushing for your addiction to be more them not showing signs of caring?
Yeah, just sort of like it was, I'll just get on with this on my own sort of thing. And it was that no one's telling me to stop. You know, I had friends that would turn around and go, you know, you should really like slow down. I'd be like, no, I'm fine, mate.
Who was it that you were waiting to tell you to stop? Who was the person that you were waiting for you to be able to start making a change?
I don't know anyone, really. No one.
You say anyone, no one, you just said your friends.
Yeah, but they used to tell me to slow down. No one told me to just stop.
Okay.
And there was always that, I guess I was always waiting for maybe my dad or someone like that. My dad's an alcoholic, and it was always that, you know, I don't want to turn into an alcoholic, so I'm going to turn into a drug addict.
Yeah, I've been reading this book on karma, not like, oh, you're going to get what's coming to you, karma, like karma and how you manage it. And it's one of the things that states in there is about blaming your genetic gene pool for why you suffer something negative as an adult. And one of them was, if your family have addictions, that means you're going to have addiction. But it was stating that it's you telling yourself that you are going to have an addiction because it's within your genetics. Scientifically, I couldn't tell you. Possibly that's true. We'll have to have a look into it and see if it is a genetic thing. But it did blow my mind. I sat there and I thought to myself, you know, wow, like if I sit there and go, well, my dad or my mum has got that, so I'm going to have it, like, and just accept it.
Yeah, you just accept it.
You don't bypass it. You don't change the way you feel or nothing. And I've learned that just now in my adult life, just by reading this book.
Yeah.
But I'm sure then, it's like you just said, my dad was an alcoholic, which obviously you look up to your elders, your parents. They're the ones that are supposed to guide you to where it is. And if you see them doing something like staying in their pajamas till 4 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, drugs and drink on the table, more than likely you're going to follow in that pattern because you visually see that if it's okay for your mum and dad to do it, then it's okay for you to do it. And there's nothing that no one can say.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why your dad overlooked what you was doing? Because he possibly felt like he'd led you to the bottle because you've seen him do it.
And that, well, I guess there's, you know, I'm in recovery now and I now see addiction and alcoholism for what it is. And, you know, my dad's too self-obsessed with himself that he doesn't really notice for anyone else.
But then, before you, like, you've done absolutely amazing with your transformation with rehab and you know, getting yourself to where you are now. And I've got nothing but respect for that. And we will get to that a little bit on. But at that point, you didn't know. So I'm trying to take you back to that way where you're feeling and how you was feeling then.
I knew that he just cared about the drink, though, and that was always the thing. That I had quite a dysfunctional childhood.
Yeah.
And it's that lovely, where you had money and everything growing up, but I didn't really have parents. You know, my dad used to take me to the pub to spend time with me, and that was it. And, you know, I had friends in the pub when I was sort of 12, and they weren't like other kids that were in there. They were like fully grown men that would talk to me because I was just sitting on the bar doing nothing.
Of course, so you're not getting no, like, immature.
No.
I say immature just out of your age group.
No, there was no.
Then, so you're dealing with, you're dealing, talking, managing, and handling yourself around adults as a child.
Yeah.
And
I sort of see all I turned to drugs because I didn't want to continue being an alcoholic sort of thing. Yeah. I didn't want to turn into an alcoholic. So I picked the other option, which was, okay, well, I'm just going to do these instead so that I don't have to drink every day and so that I don't turn into my dad. And that always seemed like the better thinking.
Yeah.
But
what did your dad do career-wise? Because you say you're from upper middle class.
My dad's an accountant.
Okay. So, but like even with his addiction and like he still manages to hold down a successful career.
Yeah, he held it a lot better back then. And yeah, he was still working. He used to drink in the middle of the day, but sort of like, and he was never, I'm going to drink before 12 o'clock. That was something that I learned is that like, if I don't drink before 12 o'clock, then I'm not an alcoholic.
Which leads me back to what I just said about looking up to your elders and what they do, you do.
My way around that was to just sleep till after 12 o'clock. And then it doesn't matter that I'll wake up and have a drink because it's past 12 o'clock.
Yeah. Or you've got that one, it's like it's midnight somewhere.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah, I've heard that a few times with recovering alcoholics and drug addiction. Yeah. I've heard this, it's somewhere, night somewhere.
Yeah, it's night somewhere.
Yeah. So there's always an excuse. Yeah, there's not an excuse, there's that, that one up thing where you're like, hang on a minute, you're right there.
Yeah.
But it's not normal.
Yeah.
You know,
and we over normalize everything, and because we do it for so long, then it just becomes the way that we live, and it's that we all draw an imaginary line in the sand. We're never going to cross that, and
but you notice the line gets a little bit further away from you.
Yeah, we keep drawing new lines.
And
it's that thing that because I tell myself so many lies, I've already crossed it. You know, it's back there.
Yeah.
I've gone past it, and I've drawn another one in front of me that still believes the same line.
Yeah.
Because the person that I lie to the most is myself when I'm in a using addict. You know, I will lie to myself and tell me that, you know, what I'm doing is fine. And it's all this justification that goes along with being an addict. And it's always that, it's all right, he did it. Or this always, I've seen him, he's fine now. Yeah, I'll be fine. And it's all this like, I will be okay, but I still need it now.
Yeah. Do you still feel that urge?
No, not really. It's it. it left me in, I don't know, my first 6 months of being clean and sober, the urge, the sort of allergy that the drugs create in myself, where as soon as I put one in me, I need more. Mm-hmm. That sort of, the draw to it all just sort of left me. Because every time I've used, you know, before just 3 years ago, the same thing happens. I use, I can't stop using, I carry on using, and then I want to kill myself and I end up in hospital with another failed suicide attempt.
I was gonna come to that, like your lowest point to your highest point. So your lowest point with your addiction and your steady claim to fame as what you was allowing yourself to believe that's all you needed was people to say hello, that's Squish.
Yeah.
Like, he's the man, getting drugs from him, and you become, like, you walk through the street, everyone's saying hello, and you've made it.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, when you look back and you sit there and you think to yourself, everyone knows who I am. I've got to the top of the ladder. This is where I'm making money. I'm known by everybody. I get invited to all the parties. But inside, you're ready to just die.
Yeah, just die. Yeah. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be living the way I was. And it's that sort of the first step in recovery is that my life became unmanageable. And it's not that my life was unmanageable, you know, on the outside. You could look in and go, yeah, he's holding it together. He's doing all right. Mm-hmm. But my head was unmanageable. I'd wake up in the morning and it'd be like 30 voices all screaming at me. Like, where are you getting drugs from? Who are you doing? What's this? What's that? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, I had to take those drugs to shut everything up.
Yeah.
And to just be able to function as a, you know, a semi-high functioning sort of person.
Yeah.
And it was complete unmanageability.
So was you when you was taking the all of the drugs in your lowest point, was you hoping that the next drug that you take will be the one that just finishes you off without you having to do it yourself, as opposed to, like, you know, you commit suicide?
Well, yeah, as I tried to commit it many times, you know, I've driven a car off the road twice at 80 miles an hour. Once was straight into a fence with a very big tree behind it, and I just bounced off. And I got up and walked away from it. The only injury I got was walking home. I jumped over a 6-foot wall and fell off the top of the wall and bruised my side where I landed on the ground. And then I rolled a car down the road 3 times into a field at about 80 miles an hour. And I got up from that, you know, just sort of like woke up and I was sort of inside my car. I wasn't wearing a seatbelt or anything. And yeah, I managed to pull myself out of my car. I had one injury, which was a piece of glass pushed into my side. And it was that I just can't fucking die. When I was slightly younger, I tried doing whole boxes of paracetamol. And I'd wake up in the morning, okay, I'll try 2 boxes. And I'd wake up in the morning, okay, I'll try boxing a proxin. And I'd wake up in the morning. And it was that I just couldn't ever take enough.
After you'd had the crash, I know you just said, I just can't die. After you had the crash and you'd gone through all of that, like hitting the tree, rolling your car, and then getting out of it, like, where was your head at then? Like, did you just be like, what the fuck? Or was you like, whoo, do you know what I mean? Like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, well, I just did that and I'm here.
It was like a proper fuck. I was like, the last time, which was when I rolled the car, was, I should probably go to hospital now. And that sort of like...
And you was you off your nut then?
No, I was sober. I was always sober when I crashed. I was sober the last 2 times.
So the decisions to try and just end your life is... So that just goes to show, man, that, like, when you're not on drugs, you're telling yourself that you just want to die.
Yeah.
And when you're on drugs, you're telling yourself that you're awesome and you're going out to the parties. And
yeah, well, it was always, again, it was the lie that sort of went with it. It was that I used to go out clubbing every day of the week, one, because I was making money in there, and two, because if I surround myself by happy people, then I must be happy.
Yeah, cut out the negative and replace that fun. But when you take the noise away,
I'm still sitting in the corner being depressive on my own, sort of not wanting to talk to anyone, telling everyone to fuck off. And that sort of like, I buy everyone the club shots because that'll make me feel better. And that, that I just keep doing stuff because then it will make me feel better. Not that I'm the problem. Not that it's all in here.
And it really is inside you. Yeah. You're the problem, nobody else.
Yeah, and I'll sit there and I'll blame people, places and things for why I feel like shit. But if I change cities to go somewhere else, I'll take myself with me.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to be depressed whether I'm in London or Ipswich. And it's that I take me everywhere I go. Whenever I go to meet new people, I take me to meet new people. And it's that I'm always the common factor. And I just couldn't see that when I was, when I was using and drinking.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. I remember you on the scene when I was younger and I was on the car scene and you was the man to go to for bass. And it weren't the drug bass, it was like Stereo's bass.
And that was another drug for me.
Yeah, and you was the man to go to. You had the best stereo system, you could look at a boot and say you need this size box and like you made it happen.
Yeah.
Like, where was you at when you was doing that? Because when I'd met you, I think you had a Golf at that point. I think it might have been Audi. Yeah, had loads of subs in it.
Yeah.
I would never have said you was off your tree then. Like, I would have were just a bass junkie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I was off on. I was probably on a lot of MDMA, speed, weed, alcohol. Pain medication of any sorts, and it was that back then I had a bit more. I used to be able to balance it a lot better, so I was being a smooth line. And bass was just another thing to block out the world, have my music turned up to ignorant levels because I want to acknowledge anything.
Yeah, just numb it all out.
Yeah, and if I turn it up and it's just it's just like that. It's just me in that car on my own. And I can't hear anything else, and it's just this feeling.
I get that feeling, man. Yeah, I'm on a level with you on that one. I totally understand.
And it's that complete zoning out. It's almost a type of meditation. That's how I used to use it. Just zone out completely. Don't listen to anything. And I'm just in a moment, sort of thing.
So we've hit you on your lows, and who around you knew that you was trying to commit suicide?
A couple of people. It was sort of I used to try and hide it. How did you crash your car? Oh, just going a bit too fast.
You're mad. Yeah, you're crazy. Yeah. He crashed his car. He's epic. And then you become just like, this crazy dude.
If someone else makes up a story for me, it means that I don't need to remember it because then everyone already knows.
They always say the best liars are addicts, because they do everything they can to be able to hide what it is they're doing, because they're ashamed of what it is that they do.
Yeah, we're ashamed. We're fearful. Addicts live in fear, and that is it.
What is the fear?
It's just of everything. Anything and everything, and it's that classic. I would always say, no, I'm not afraid of anything, but I'm afraid of
Was it fear of being found out?
Fear of myself. There's doubt about myself. All this shame of just me, and then there's shame of what other people might think of me, or this just crippling fear of what happens if I stop doing the drugs as well. What happens then? Because I've never lived without drugs, and then there's all that fear, and that's just. The whole world, what am I going to do today? How am I going to walk out my door? It really is a fear of everything.
Do you think all that fear comes from when you was bullied and had all the name calling from before?
Some of it, yeah. Some of it was because of the drugs, and there is a lot of paranoia that goes along with a lot of class A's. When you abuse something to abuse it, your thinking isn't right. And there is a lot of,
Of course, because you're not taking drugs for fun, are you? Drugs to abuse the drugs.
I'm taking drugs because they're my solution to living. And that's sort of how I say
it. Wow, that's powerful.
It's that solution to me being alive. And if I take it, then I don't have to be conscious of being alive, sort of thing. I can stop taking inventory of myself. And I can just sort of do things.
So you become a functioning addict.
Yeah.
So your main source of income was drug dealing.
Yeah.
What do you reckon you made over the time to what you lost and what you took?
don't know.
It's a hard one because whenever I've spoke to anyone that's dealt drugs, I always try and figure out, like, you know, for what reason have you done it? You know, like, are you gaining money? You know, you get people that get a parcel on tick, they get two parcels, they sell it, make $5,000 on top of each one, depending on what the drug is, of course. Street value today, I don't know, but depending on what the drug is. And then a parcel goes missing.
Yeah.
They haven't actually, they're now less money than what they had when they first had the parcel. So they're on a buzz that they're up. Now they're in fear that they're down. And they've got to try and manage this. So the only way to do it is take some of the drugs that they've got, which puts them in a negative again.
Yeah, even more.
It goes from that. So how was that for you, with being able to take the amount of drugs that you were doing to making the money to survive, to be able to...
It was always that I'd just sell more. So quite early on, I got to selling quite a lot of drugs, and I'd do it for quite a few different people. And it was that if I keep turning over this amount, then I always have enough for myself and I can still make profit to pay everyone off. And it was that simple, that if I ever needed, if my intake went up, then my selling had to go up.
Right, okay. So
And then when it was, that's not quite cutting it, okay, I'll just switch to selling something that's got more value. And then we'll just, you know, do that. So it was always on to the next thing. And it, you know, my selling progressed with how much I was taking to a degree. I wasn't turning around mad profit, because I was, you know, I was sniffing, I was eating, I was smoking, I was doing whatever I could with it.
Plus buying everyone's shots in the club.
Yeah, and trying to fix myself with that sort of aspect. So, you know, I was still ending up at home and going, at £300, I'm a little bit down. It's like, that's all right, just go out tomorrow, sell a bit more, work a little bit harder, and then that'll be fine. So, yeah, I was making a little bit of profit, but yeah, it was for what I was doing personally. Yeah.
So if you was to get caught and end up in jail, was what you was doing worth the money you was making?
Oh, hell no.
Did you ever get turned over?
No. I managed to dodge every time through the grace of God. I can't say it was through anything else, because, you know, so many run-ins with the police with drugs on me, and enough to get put in prison, you know. Or now, with today's standards, you know, I probably would have got let off. But back then, you know, it was, this was when everything was being moved up classes and they were proper hot on it. So it was a bit more of a thing. And yeah, I was always going around with enough to get me arrested and probably had a sentence. So it was never worth it. But, you know, I wasn't doing it for the profit. I was doing it to sort of cure myself. So
maintain your addiction. Yeah. Yeah, that's a real, I feel sad, like, hearing your story, that you have to be able to put yourself in a position that you don't really want to do, to be able to maintain an addiction or a feeling that you're suffering with. I can't imagine what must have been going through your head and the way that your body was feeling at that time. Trying to cluck, flush, and eat, like, feed your body with these drugs to be able to maintain just our normal 24/7 lifestyle. I get up sometimes, I'm tired, I'm like, oh, bloody hell, you know, I'll have a cup of tea or something, you know. But yeah, for you, it was very much different.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure a lot of people from the outside looking in is probably just going, he's a junkie, he's a crackhead. Even if that wasn't the drug you were taking, that's automatically what you'd get branded with, which of course isn't going to help you from a visual or a mental aspect.
And like, I dropped down to about 8 stone at my lightest, you know, you could see all of my ribs. Sort of.
So how did that work with you? Because you've gone from being a fat kid that everyone picked on to being a fat kid that was now liked because you was selling drugs, to completely a different visual look.
Yeah.
How was that for you?
That was a really good, I remember, so I lost about 2 stone in about 2 weeks, you know, cocaine diet.
Yeah.
It cost me a lot, but you know, it achieved something that I could never just do on my own. And it was that amazing feeling that, you know, I can fit into 28-inch waist jeans, you know. And that was something that I'd never experienced, that being skinny. So it was, you know, it went to my head, it made my ego go nuts.
How was that with girls? Like, what did you have a girlfriend when you was like off in your head, not looking the way that you?
Not really. I had sort of one girl that I was with when I was maybe about 16.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I found class A's at sort of 17. And then, yeah, it was like suddenly I was a bit attractive and sort of people were like, oh, you really look different. Like, wow.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just
a you gained a whole new ego.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, you're carrying yourself completely different, almost like you've just pulled yourself out of a comic book and just decided to be that person for the day. Yeah.
And it was that it happened so quickly. It was just, you know, I can just switch completely and, you know, I'll just start being this person. That's fine. Okay, we'll go along with it.
And that obviously affected your relationship with that girl.
Oh, well, she did things that, you know, I wasn't a nice person, but, you know, she wasn't a nice person either. she did certain things as well that, you know, probably should be speaking about on here, but we left her anyway.
Cut.
End.
End. Done.
Find a new one. Oh, no. Her name's, you know, Speed and Weed. So,
yeah.
It's a wonderful replacement for a breakup. I wouldn't advise it to anyone.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, like, especially now where you're going through your rebuild stage, which of course is an everyday thing. It's not just just minimizing as and when you want to pick it up. Oh, I'm struggling with that. I'll go to my meeting. You know, it's one of them that you're battling with on a constant basis.
Yeah.
And I know that you stumbled across a few different things on meditation stuff because you tried to get me to do it.
You wanted to use your turtle to meditate with.
Yeah. That didn't work for me.
No.
Like, I wish it did. I really do. I wish it did.
Well, it feels Zen-like.
Yeah, I was from the home turtle. Yeah, I wish it did because the way you described it to me, it really sounded like it worked for you.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it just didn't for me, and I am gutted about it.
But I had to find different. There are so many different ways of meditating, and it was that I got told I had to meditate, and I was like, I don't want to sit down on the floor, you know, arms crossed or doing a silly pose. And you know, I tried that because that was what I thought meditation was. And I was like, I just can't get into it. And then someone was like, you know, you don't have to be sitting like a knobhead on the floor. And I was like, what? Like it was new information to me. And they were like, you can just lay down on your bed. And I was like, why did no one tell me that? Because it's funny to watch you. I was like,
yeah, you're just sitting there like, like,
great, thanks for that. And it because, was...
Oh, when you was telling me, I'm trying to cross my legs, mate. I got no hope.
Yeah.
Cross my legs. I'm sitting more upright. Like,
and it was that, like, you can just meditate however you want. And that was sort of it. And I went, oh, okay, I can give that a go. And for me, it was sitting by the beach, just holding a stone and sort of like putting everything into that stone, you know, all the sort of hate or anger or sadness or anything like that, and just sort of trying to channel it into something.
Yeah, reversing like, energy.
Yeah. And just sitting there, and that was what worked for me. I needed to be holding something. And you know, some people stare at a candle and a flame, and some people listen to music, and you know, it's just so many different ways of doing something.
Mm.
And it's being open-minded to try them all.
Yeah. So going back to where you was at your low, and you was forcing death upon yourself. Where was you at your high?
In the madness. I've never had one, and that's sort of the honest truth. I look back now, and I was never happy. There was never a time when I'll go back to that moment.
There's never that point where you was just like, I'm fucking living. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is where I'm at.
Well, it's like the first time I did cocaine, I was sitting in a caravan with a load of guys, you know, living the dream. And, you know, and now I look back at that and go, that's fucking miserable. Every time I look back and I go, I'm so miserable.
Yeah, a lot of people, and they try and do, like, drugs like pie, drugs, cocaine, stuff like that, to, you know, be around girls and stuff.
Yeah, Yeah, just sitting there with all my mates, just like, why are we doing this?
That's what I'm saying. Like, at what point do you all sit there and go, yeah, let's buy like one of the most expensive drugs on the market?
And we'll sit here and play Forza. Like,
yeah, and like, let's sit in a caravan and take drugs.
For my first time, I think I was 17, just coming up for 18, I was like, yeah, it seems like a great idea. Like,
you're sitting there off your tits, like,
You're right, mate. Yeah, mate. Yeah. And I never had that. I never really had that really chatty stage of anything because I was so wrapped up in my own stuff.
So you're taking this drug that don't shut you up. It don't let you sleep. Yeah, and you spend the whole time just
sitting in the corner. Yeah, sitting in the corner, just quiet, just like.
So do you think like that time when you was taking the drug, you were just taking it because everyone else in the room was taking it?
Yeah, and I always had that curiosity of like someone said to me, you'll only start smoking because of peer pressure. So my best thinking was I'll start smoking because I want to.
Yeah.
I'm like, now I'm curious, why do people get me to start smoking? I'm going to try this for myself and I'm going to see what it's about. And then it was like, someone went, don't ever do cocaine. And I was like, well, why shouldn't I ever do cocaine?
Yeah.
I'm going to go do it. I'm going to try it. And it was always that.
Going against the grain.
Yeah. And someone would go, I've got this. And everyone would go, no, I'm not doing that. And I'd be like, I'm up for it. Yeah, cool.
What about rejection of not doing it? Did you feel like if you didn't do the same as what they're all doing, that you would slowly be driven out from the circle that you've tried to become so comfortable in?
I guess a little bit, but I was just up for it. You could get out any blister pack with pills in, I'd be like, we've got them. I was that, I will just try, I would just try anything. I was that, I wanted to try everything, so I knew what everything did, sort of thing. If I knew that there might be that one drug around the corner that might help, might shut my head up, and I won't need everything else.
But you, like any other addict, knows that first hit is the only time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rest of it is just chasing. Just
chasing to try and make up for that first time.
Yeah. Because you out of all the drugs that you've done many times, the break from drugs, the go back to the drug, the like mixing, the like just to the point of nearly dying, have you ever felt that first hit ever again?
No. And even when I relapsed, it was the most anticlimactic relapse ever. I got it and I did it and went, I'm sort of all right, can I get some more? And it was that it didn't give me those, you know, shooting rainbows out of my palms feeling.
Did you feel like you was making excuses because you never felt it after going back to it, after being away from it for so long? You say relapsing, which relapsing is where you've had a long period of time away from drugs,
yeah,
and then you just have a down day and then just go back to it because that's what you know, that's what you need, that escape,
yeah,
to be able to escape that feeling you're feeling then. I know you know it, but some of the people that listen might not know, so I was just explaining.
Yeah. So I'd maybe done 5-6 months, and then I was getting lunch one day and I was just like, I'm just going to try and have a vodka. I just kind of warm one. And, you know, I got one, and then 10 hours.
What was the day? Talk me through that day.
Nothing had happened.
Nothing?
No, it was, you know, I'd woken up, I was like, I'm going to go out and get lunch. I feel like going to get lunch. So I popped into town, I went to Vodka Rebs. They used to do really nice Detroit fries or something like that. And I was like, just fancy eating that today. Yeah.
Did you feel like you were strong enough to go and eat in a place that is...
Yeah, that's called Vodka Rebs.
Vodka Rebs.
Yeah, and I did. That's
like got alcohol at hand.
And I did back then. And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And I sat down and I started looking at all the pretty vodkas and went, I really want one of those. And then I went, I'm just going to have one. You know, there was no like second thought or anything. And then I didn't even have a pretty vodka. I just got a normal triple vodka. And then just sat down and was like, I just drank it how I normally have. Just went straight back in time to where I left off. And, you know, it was gone in about 2 minutes. And then I went, I'll have another one. And I had another one. And then I should probably go home now. And I went home and sort of made it till about 10 o'clock. And went, I'm going out.
That's, PM.
Yeah. And then I was like, I'm going out. That's what I need. I need to go out. I was sort of rattling around my house, just like, oh, I can't sleep now, and I want to do stuff. And yeah, I went out, and then it took me, I don't know, 20 minutes before I found someone. I went, can you pick up coke? And then he went, yeah, and I was like, here, take the money, go get it for me. He came back, and I was like, I didn't even speak to him. I was just like, give it. Did the whole bag, and then went, can you get more? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, cool, go get it then. And that sort of like, I picked up exactly where I left off.
Am I? It's just crazy how you could 6 months of probably pure pain to get you to the point where it took you less than 24 hours, it took you less than 12 hours to get back to where you was 6 months before.
Yeah. And then it progressed, and then it just progressed on from there, you know. It was,
if that doesn't tell you how powerful addiction is, then those that are standing on the outside looking and judging should really take a step back and just realize the statistics there of like the time that it took for you to get to that point, just that one decision that you made that day.
Yeah, just have 12 hours.
And it's
always that, can you not have a vodka? Can you not have like one pint? And it's like, no, I really can't.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, I noticed that when you are surrounded by people that do drink and stuff. I'm not really a drinker, so, but like, you know, my friends around me know that I don't really drink. So they're not on it. But people that don't know us, and they go, oh, what are you drinking? What are you drinking? And I'm like, oh, now I'm right. Like, go on, you can have one. So I get the pressure from the outside. But having that on top of addiction, and for you to say no to that, has probably got to be one of the most powerful things that you could do as an addict.
Well, I just play it forward for them. You know, I tell them I'm a drug addict. If you get me to have one drink, then I'll carry on drinking with you all night. I'll make you seem like it's a good idea to buy me cocaine, and then I'll go back to your house to do it. I'll knock you out, and I'll take it all and take your stuff. And they go, yeah, I don't really want to buy you a drink now. And I'm like, good, fuck off.
Yeah. You just give it a load down there.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's going to happen over the next 6 hours, and you're not really going to enjoy that. So, don't buy me a drink.
So you, just jumping on that whole, the way that you described that with the violence side of things, how did that come into play with you and your addiction? Would you say that you was quite... I know you say you're suffering down, but you was portraying yourself to be happy and this drug dealer. Did that come with you being pretty handsy, hands-on, aggressive?
I was never particularly aggressive. I mean, I had one of those faces where you're like, it just looks... Because I was always so fucking miserable. And it was that people would look at me and just be like... I used to be at parties and I'd be doing drugs, and they'd be like, are you all right, mate? And I'd be like, yeah, mate, I'm having a wicked time. And they're like... But you look like you're about to kill me. And I'm like, no, mate, I'm doing drugs. I'm having a wicked time. And they're like, yeah, I'm just going to go sit over there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had that sort of, I always looked like I was pissed off at the world, because I sort of was. And, you know, I could talk the talk. You know, that's sort of what had to happen. I remember the first time someone owed me money, and I was like, I just really don't care. And someone was like, no, you have to make it. You have to go do it. You have to make an issue. You have to make a point out of this. I was like, but, you know, I was still a little scared kid at heart. Can you come with me? He was like, no, mate, you've got to go do it on your own. Or, you know, threatening someone with a crowbar and just being like, I don't know. Like, what do I do? Just sort of smashing stuff. And I give my fucking money. And then it sort of was like, yeah, that feels all right. He gave me my money.
You know? A new addiction to your resume of, like,
everything just adding it in. And, yeah, it was that sort of, like, I'd be a really nice guy, and then you piss me off, and I could switch. I could have manic episodes as well.
So did you get a high from that too?
Yeah, a little bit. It's that sort of, I used to love standing up to people in nightclubs and just taking the piss out of them. So I'd say anything to anyone, because I wanted to die, so it didn't matter if you beat me up. And I was that sort of, I was a wired looking, like, I guess I look crazy at points in my life. And it was that, you know, just walk up to you and be like, fucking hit me.
Yeah, or just starting on having a fight because you wanted them to be able to...
Or I was always trying. I rarely had them, but I was always trying to start fights with people.
With you doing that, the whole vicious circle of you now becoming the kids that bullied you, you've now done a full circle you've now become the bully.
Yeah.
How did that sit with you?
Never really thought of it that much. Someone once pointed it out to me, and I was like, okay, that's fine. I was like, I got bullied, now I'm going to bully other people.
Yeah.
And that
was always like,
you know, nothing could stop me though. It was, if anything got in the way of my using, you know, I'd get rid of that out of my life. So, you know, if someone was going to say that they didn't like me, I'd go, that's fine, I don't need to talk to you again. You know, move on, replace, upgrade, keep moving.
And I'm sure in the drug game, I know what it's like in the criminal fraternity of being able to replace people. There's always someone that's wanting to take the top spot. So when your right hand man has let you down, there's always someone willing to jump straight back in that place. So I'm sure true friendship is harder to forge in them circumstances, because your needs are serviced and met as long as you are producing you as a product.
Yeah.
If you're there and you've got my back, you're my right hand man. As soon as you let me down, you're gone, and he's my right hand man.
Keep going. And then it was, you know, I got done for drink driving and stuff like that. You know, I lost my driving license. Can you come pick me up? You know, you said you owed me a favour. Now, mate, I'm busy.
Yeah.
You know, it's always that you lose your license and you find out who your true friends are.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's like throughout life, like when something happens where it truly does affect you, I think you do truly find out who your friends are. I went from having a massive circle to, you know, when things happened along the way with me on my life journey, whether it be separation from a girl or losing my brother, you know, I found that my circle just halved every single time. But the ones that are stuck by me, I'd do anything for. Do you know what I mean? I would absolutely do anything for the people that are still within my life now.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that all of the others are gone. You know, because like they're just wasting my time. You know, like the fake friendships. I'm with you because of what I can get, or you know, I'm with you because you know this person and that person. I can gain notoriety because I'm friends with you or something like that. So, yeah, I do get that, and I'm sure that on your journey from becoming drug dealer and then becoming feared a bit because, you know, you're twist and snap, and having a fight in a nightclub definitely adds to a fear factor that you don't care. As opposed to if you was just seeing someone in the street and being like, fuck you, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it's a lot different because you're doing it in front of so many more people.
And then I used to
glamorise.
And it was that thing of, I used to get in a fight and then I'd be allowed to still go around for the rest of the night in the nightclub with everyone going, didn't you get in a fight? And I'm like, yeah, it's gone now.
Yeah,
and that's sort of like, you know, I've got left in there, you know, blood all down my shirt. And it's like, I did get smacked in the face and I smacked him and now he's out.
What happened with you was telling me about a time when someone stabbed you with a pencil.
Oh yeah, so I was it was a lot earlier than the nightclubs, but it was that same thing. You know, I'd say anything to anyone because I just didn't care, and you know, I was high all the time, and I said something to a guy and just kept winding him up. And I was with a load of like younger mates, and I was just taking the piss out of this guy, and then I was just standing there. And he was sort of shouting at me and sort of saying stuff. And I was like, yeah, I'm out, mate. And I turned around and he just like, it was like a thin metal file. It was about that long, you know, like a pencil.
Yeah.
Just sort of jammed it in my shoulder. And then I took
a little bit of an ice pick.
Yeah, that sort of type thing. And yeah, I took the piss out of him walking away. It's just sort of like, oh, I'm in so much fucking pain.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to die. And I got around the corner and I was like, that actually really does hurt. Yeah, can we go deal with that?
Yeah.
But still wound you up walking away because that was the sort of person I was. I think there was always a part of me that wanted him to come back and keep going.
Yeah. So with you, you said you was with a younger group and you are tormenting another guy, which, again, I'm saying that massive circle with you becoming the bully, you've got so comfortable at it now that you're actually using it to show off in front of your younger peers, which in turn, they look up to you and that's going to go on for them. So it's that vicious circle of like, you know, you are the elder that they look up to and you are showing them that you're a badass by being a bully, which is, you know, something that you struggled with from a very young age.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to try and be like, what the fuck were you thinking, man? Do you know what I mean? Like, but then again, you wasn't thinking.
I wasn't.
When this guy, did you see him pull out the ice pick?
Yeah, I did. And I even wound him up about pulling something out. And sort of like, it was like, oh, you're going to stab me? And he was like, yeah, it's like, go on then.
Did you think that he would do, or do you think it was just a show?
It was just all taking the piss and sort of like that. That I was just so off my face. It's sort of that those sort of thoughts never, it was, I never thought about the consequences of anything.
Yeah.
You know, it was always in the moment, yeah, go on then. And he used to be that person that would smile as you punched me just to wind you up even more.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a bit of a shock. And that was, and then it was like, oh okay.
Did that change the way that you was with picking on people from then after, because you just had a sharp shock to like, yeah, wait a minute, I could have died last night.
Yeah, well, no, I didn't even think that. I was like, I got stabbed, so now I'll carry around a knife with me in case that happens again, but I'll have a bigger knife.
Yeah,
and it was that sort of like...
What kind of knife did you start carrying around?
I had sort of flick-out lock knives and stuff like that. And, you know, ones with metal breakers on the end, because then I don't even need to get the knife out and stuff like that. And it was all like, you know, it was, and that's what happened to me because of it. My using went up because then I was a bit more fearful of my life and my day. So I used a bit more drugs to get over that. And then, you know, it was that comfort of carrying around a knife. I didn't want to knife anyone, but if someone tried to get me, then I had it there. That sort of, again, I perpetuated this vicious circle and then just carried on going with it.
And it's so crazy because from start to now, all you wanted for all of this was for your dad just to say, son, stop.
Yeah, or give me a hug.
Give you a hug.
Yeah.
Did he ever hug you?
No.
Has he ever hugged you?
Yeah. But, you know.
Did it have that?
No. I hug my sponsor now instead of hugging my dad. My sponsor is more like a brother and a dad to me than mine ever is. And you know, when I went through a breakup not that long ago, I went to my sponsor's house to get a hug. I didn't let my dad know. And, you know, he gave me a hug the way I needed a hug at that moment. And that's sort of it. And it was always, you know. He congratulated me. It'd been 3 years the other day by looking away from me and drinking wine.
Your dad?
Yeah. He said, well done for getting 3 years. He was sitting in a chair, I was standing behind him.
That's tough to hear, man. So you feeling that is, you kind of stubbed me there a little bit there, mate. I just sitting there thinking to myself, I never had a dad growing up, you know. That was, I don't know whether that was a choice that was given to me, chosen for me, or whether my dad genuinely wanted something to do with us or my mum didn't. I don't really know.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the point of thinking, I remember thinking, I wish my dad was here himself so he could see what I've become or who I've become. And I knew that he never was going to come. But that's my story, man. But I'm just saying, like, I can relate to the need for a man in my life. You know, yeah. my mum had husbands, you know, but he was never...
Never had that connection.
He was never my dad. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, you have literally run yourself to the point of several suicides, being bullied, having no one to turn to, but the need to turn to.
Yeah.
And when you pull it all apart, the person that you truly wanted to just stand up and say, come here, is your dad.
Yeah.
And I feel that even though you go to your sponsor, you still wish it was your dad that you was hugging. No. And that was hugging you back.
Not really.
No?
My sponsor holds so much more weight than my dad now. And that's how the program works. You know, that's how my life works now. And I just accept my dad's an alcoholic, you know. And it's a lot.
Does he accept it?
No.
He doesn't accept it?
No, he doesn't accept he's an alcoholic.
How does that make you feel?
It's painful, but, you know, I can't ever force recovery on anyone. I can't ever judge anyone and say that they're an alcoholic.
You have to want recovery to be successful.
And it's that, it's easier for me to say that my dad's an alcoholic and accept that than it is to accept that he's just a shit dad, really. And it's easier for me to identify as being an alcoholic because I'm an alcoholic addict and just go, yeah, I get that. You know, I step over my daughter for drugs. So he's stepping over his son for alcohol. And I don't need to have I don't need to be a part of his life the same way that I had that want to be his son. And I accept that I don't need that, you know, and I can have a more meaningful relationship with, say, my sponsor. I can get so much more from my sponsor, you know. My dad's never told me about girls or anything like that. And, you know, he's never gave me wisdom on how to live life other than sitting in a pub sort of thing. And I can talk to my sponsor. I have a spiritual connection with him. You know, I can talk to him about anything, and I do mean anything. He knows everything about me because that's part of the program. And, you know, he's more of a brother and a dad than my dad ever was.
Yeah. If your dad had to describe himself just off the cuff, how would he describe himself?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know what goes on in his
man's head. Man. I'd go down the pub and I'd, you know.
No, he's not even that. He's quite soft, really, you know, but I don't know. Eccentric, something like that. I don't know how he works, and I don't want to. And that's sort of it. I can let that live.
You have got to that point where you've just given up on what makes him tick.
Yeah. I spent so long of my childhood wanting a normal dad that was like the other dads, but I'd only ever experienced my dad. So it was always sort of normal. And it was that, you know, I wanted something else, but I've never experienced it, so I didn't know what I wanted.
Yeah.
And then it comes down to it when I got a bit older. I was like, I just want my dad to stop drinking, really.
Mm.
And I've got to that point now where it's like, I just don't need my dad. You know, it's that I've progressed on from that. I need.
Yeah, we all go through life feeling like we can't survive without somebody else.
Mm.
And, you know, that whole term is you truly need to love yourself before you could let anyone else love you. Yeah. This is absolutely live by the book.
Yeah.
True. Because if you start any form of relationship with hate for yourself, it's only going to be a negative outcome.
Yeah.
And you've wasted so much time on something and damaged further lives or anything on that thing. So
yeah.
Finding yourself, understanding yourself, and coming to terms with what and who you are, and then loving yourself, that's hard work.
Yeah.
That is hard work. Yeah, because if you don't love yourself and then you try and find someone to love you, how are they supposed to do that if what you're feeling you don't like? How do you expect somebody else to like?
Yeah.
You know? So again, another circle. So we go from there. So do you find yourself going from like wanting to hating, blaming, your dad for the lack of ownership to his responsibility towards you?
I did, and there was that whole like. So I've already said I used to sort of isolate away from my family and stuff like that, and it was always just easier to do that and not be involved with them. And there was this sort of part of me that was like there was that sort of like, thanks, Dad, thanks for this. That sort of blame. It's easier to blame someone else than it is to own up to our own things. And there was a part of that. And then it's, you know, through getting into recovery and sort of seeing my part in things, that was the real big thing. You know, I had to do steps. And one of my steps was to write down, you know, problems with other people and then look at my part in it. And, you know, I filled out this massive section for my dad, and everything that I've wrote down, I then filled out in the section for my part in it. And I was like, oh, I've turned into him, you know.
Oh, wow. So
it was that it doesn't matter that I did drugs, I still turned into him. And all of my hostilities against him and all the things that I blame him for are all stuff that I do back to him anyway. And, you know, I broke down and, you know, I had to pray to have all these things removed. And that was my sort of spiritual awakening. I was like, I'm making a change. And, you know, I don't have to be him anymore. And I don't have to, like, try and save him either. There's that I can do this for me and no one else.
Yeah, yeah. And that was your final stage to the outcome that you are now for your recovery was realizing that you become the man that you now know you didn't want to be.
Yeah.
which was your father.
Yeah. And also the realization that I didn't need him. You know, I don't need anyone else to make me better. I need to make myself better. You
know, I think it's so much more powerful if you want someone in your life and not need someone in your life.
Yeah.
Because I find that if you go through trying to need people, I think they become slowly irrelevant. Because with need, you become stronger. And if you become stronger, that need gets weaker.
Yeah.
Because you're self-sustaining that need for something else now. So once you need and you get it, it's kind of like moving on. Where if you want someone, you then start creating the foundations to what could be like truly beautiful. But,
yeah. And there's as well with that need, that what happens when that need gets taken away?
Yeah.
And what happens if it goes the other way? What if you don't get stronger and you need it more? What happens when if that person leaves you and then you're left there with nothing? And then you have to try and, you know, that love's an addiction in itself, you know, then I have to try and fill that gap with something else or fill that void that's then been created by this need.
Just about to say void, yeah, perfect word for that. So speaking from strength, which I can hear in your voice now, you are talking from your recovery point of view. And you can, I noticed the change from your tone, from talking from recovery. What are you doing, or what have you done within your recovery to now you've benefited yourself so much that you now help others? Tell us about that.
So I got into an anonymous group, which I will name, which is Cocaine Anonymous. It's all inclusive.
It's also supposed to be anonymous.
I know, but I'm gonna let you know. It's also got to stay out of the media as well. But I don't care. I don't do anonymity. I would like people to know that I'm a recovering addict, because otherwise people might know that it's, you know, I never thought that it was possible to get clean, and I never had anyone telling me that it was possible to get clean, because I used to associate with other addicts.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm now a person that will sit there and go, yeah, it's possible. You know, I was possibly, you know, one of the, you know, I was up there for users, definitely, and how quickly my life fell apart, and you know, I have got it together now. But you know, I got involved with groups, I got involved with anonymous groups. I started sitting down, I started trying to trust people for the first time and believe that people were telling me the truth about themselves. And then I did what was suggested by being in those groups, you know, get a sponsor, work the steps. I work a 12-step program now. I had to get taught how to do it. I've already said I had to be taught how to meditate, because I didn't know how to do that. Someone had to tell me to get down on my knees to pray, because I didn't want to get down on my knees. I was like, I'm not doing that. So I don't want to get down on my knees. Like, I don't get down on my knees.
I had so much
ego though, you know, why am I going to get down on my knees in the morning? I don't want to do that. But that was essential for me to grow spiritually, to grow in myself, to admit defeat, to admit, you know, admit that I could be vulnerable, and to break my ego. Because, you know, we've talked about how, you know, a lot of the stuff in my life was just to make my ego bigger or to do that. And it was this breaking of ego that sort of went, oh, okay, I can ask for help. And I can do these things if someone else helps me, I don't have to do everything on my own.
And it's not until you start breaking away from all the things you thought that is good for you.
All the things I needed.
Yeah, there's that thing again, that all the things you need, that you then realise that you gain a sense of empowerment from, like, understanding that you don't need these things.
No. And there was a lot of fear around detoxing, because, of course, I needed the drugs.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I went through a horrible withdrawal. Been through horrible withdrawals, you know, multiples of them.
How many times have you gone to rehab?
I've only gone to rehab once, but I've done home detoxes four times.
Four times.
You know, full on, carrying around a bowl because I can't function without throwing up.
Yeah.
Hot and cold. I do full on junkie withdrawals.
I feel like you're your strongest that you've been now. Do you feel the same?
Yeah. You know, it's... The urge to use just left me so long ago.
Yeah.
It feels like so long. You know, 3 years is such a short period of time in the grand scheme of things. But it does take work, and it does take a daily a daily reprieve. You know, it does take me doing stuff on a daily basis to get rid of that sort of demon, as you will.
Yeah.
And that sort of, if I do everything right in the way that it's suggested, I might have my own little twist on doing things, but, you know, as long as I'm doing them, then I stay okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure that you, the people that you talk to, whether they're at the centre you're at, or you've done talks in prisons and stuff like that, that these people can relate and respect you because you've been down that road. Yeah. You ain't a textbook warrior.
Oh, no.
You know, you've been there. And same for me when me and, you know, there's me and Jamie Hartley, you know, Jamie, we go out to these schools and youth clubs and stuff, and we do talks. I can talk and they listen to me because I'm from that background. And we gain so much more respect and understanding with the people that we deal with.
Yeah.
And I'm very much sure that it's the same for you.
Yeah. The only way getting clean is with one addict helping another. Because, you know, if you're not an addict, then you haven't been through it and you don't know what's going on, sort of thing. And it is that simple, you know. And it only works when one addict helps another. And that's sort of why I carry on in recovery and help other people. Because if I stop helping people, then I lose it. And, you know, if I stop helping people, then there might not be anyone to help the next person. And that sort of it. I got help when I came in, so I now have to give it on. Otherwise, you know,
yeah, it's following that journey and passing it along.
We start a new circle now, and that's it. You know, we live our lives in these vicious circles, and now we start a new kind of circle.
When you come up to a brand new addict trying to get clean, do you get tempted?
Not really.
Are you listening? Are you listening to that person talking and you're thinking,
no,
do you know
around,
what? I missed that.
I've been around drugs quite a lot. I've been around alcohol even more. Alcohol's just, when you get sober and you view drunk people, it's like, what?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, 100%.
Yeah, drunk females are the best, especially alcohol.
Honestly, whenever we go away and that lot, because I don't really drink.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we got kids, so the missus, like, she lets her hair down. And I end up just getting her pissed because she's so funny when she's pissed. You know, I could do this because I know that she's not going to suffer with an alcohol addiction. But I could sit back and just watch her and a couple of the other girls,
it all happen and you're just like, doesn't seem that attractive anymore.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
I don't want to be in that. Like, but when you watch people go to like blackout and then
that whole hole in the hair and stuff.
And that's that point that I always used to get to. Blackout was always that goal.
Yeah.
And it was that, if I'm not going to get there, then why am I starting? And I sort of watch people get to that point, then it's that, why? Why did I need to do this?
Mm.
And I've been around people smoking weed. You know, I went down to Camden not that long ago and walked past a whole
yeah, that's happening down there.
A whole thing of it. And, you know, it smells nice. I can go, oh, I like that smell.
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of, you know, when I smoked it. And then I go, oh, yeah, it reminds me of when I smoked it. And I'm carrying walking.
Wow, so you really have got past that. I'm not saying that it's the battle's not easier, you've got to that point now, and that's really nice to hear. It's nice to see. It's good to see that you're doing well. I'll just touch on a subject that happened to you the other day. You literally come down to my studio to find out the times that we were doing this, and you bumped into, no names, like you bumped into someone, and they started saying things to you.
It was on Instagram, and you know, someone turned around to me and blamed me for the death of someone they knew, and you know that you are the reason for this, you know, and I'm sure, as I've said, the only person that knows everything about me is my sponsor, and you know, everyone else gets a slightly edited version of my story for this very reason, you know. Now, if you let people know too much about yourself when you're in this sort of thing, then, you know, people can use it against you.
And of course,
And they use it in very vicious ways. And they shift blame on you and they make up things in, you know, to incriminate you.
Yeah, and you're going to get your haters, man, 100%. Yeah. Like, you know, I've never let myself go on anything, you know, but I felt like when I was doing my message, like how you're doing your message, we normally touch on the knife crime spectrum of what it is, but We've been getting emails and we get people saying, oh, you should, we'd like to hear you do other things like mental health, addiction, self-harming. And we're going to get round to all of that lot. So when you come in that day, it just was right that it was you that we've done the addiction thing because of your journey's been so powerful.
I'll come back in and do self-harm and mental health.
Because
that's how my journey progressed. You know, there was that much hate. That there was self-harm and there was also a large part of mental health that goes along with addiction.
Yeah.
And now it's that's another thing that I try and do for recovery is I'm a mental health first aider. And I try and be, you know, it's that all these good things start happening and you just got to keep going with them, keep doing it. And it was an opportunity that got presented to me and I was like, yeah, cool. You know.
So, and none of this triggers you anymore?
No.
That's powerful, man. You know, it just goes to show.
The person the other day that's sending me messages, that gets to me that someone would want to use that.
To trigger you.
Yeah, and someone is clearly trying to do something, or, you know, they might be having fun, or they might be angry, or, you know, whatever. Someone is not 100% and they're using it to get at someone else.
Yeah.
And that's sad.
You know? Yeah. I mean, when I put my videos out there, man, I had some private messages come through, and do you know what it is? I like, for me, I'm like, you just like, you can say as much hatred as you want and try and take the piss out of the situation, but to me, you're just silence.
Yeah. And it was that
just silence, because you do it on a private account.
Yeah. And like, someone turned, and it was that she turned around to me and went, Karma's gonna get you. And I was like, I'm doing everything I can to help Karma along its way.
Yeah.
I'm doing everything I possibly can to stop my old habits, to stop people making the same mistakes that I made, you know, and I've got no problem sharing everything with someone if they're willing to listen. And if they take one thing from it that's going to help them along their journey, then I've done, then I'm doing good in my life. And that is the goal now, is to just help as many people as I can to get better 1% each day. And eventually we'll get to a full 100%. And that's sort of it. It's that small little thing. That, you know, if everyone did, it'd be so much of a better day.
Oh yeah, 100%. We're so fixated on isolating ourselves from issues that we fail to help someone that's struggling. The same thing you are, even though you feel the pain and you know the pain that they're going through, we still are stupid enough to isolate ourselves from this problem that we're setting off a spectrum of events that is just like, I could have helped you there. But because I ain't got time.
And now I want to be that person that always has the time. You know, if you lose your driving license, I want to give you a lift and I want to talk to you about why you lost your driving license.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if I can help, then I will.
That's good, sort of it.
And it's, someone said, how is this sort of thing going to stop knife crime? And I was like, because if it helps one person, then that's one stop.
Oh, man.
You know, it doesn't have to stop it. But, you know, if we're not trying, then what's the point in trying?
When you say that and you say, how does this stop knife crime? The problem that we have with, like, what stops knife crime? And there is no answer.
No.
Yeah. But our journey to help people try and understand knife crime is massive.
And it's the knowledge. It's the, you know.
Well, this is it. The knowledge that you've gained from, like, or me, I've gained from this, you said you haven't thought about it, is mental health, addiction, and all of the above all has a stepping stone to a tsunami of events, that can happen. Now, you was taking drugs and you've been sad and you had your addiction and things like that, but it led you to one, being stabbed with an ice pick, two, carrying a knife. How is that not a message?
Yeah.
How is that not a message to say, how does this help with knife crime?
And, you know, that's it took, what, like 4 years from coming out of a private school to then be in that place.
Exactly. And, you know, you've private education. You think to yourself, private educated, you're going to be someone like a lawyer, a solicitor, you know, like, which is the same thing.
And it's that thing, but it's like, this stuff happens to everyone. It's like addiction crime happens to everyone.
Nothing is exempt. Yeah. No one is exempt from an issue. You know, everyone is where they're at. And my message to the people that said, how does this message today raise awareness in knife crime? Because addiction, sadness, bullying, drugs, drink, not being loved correctly by a family member you want so badly led you to not only taking drugs, drinking, bullying, knife, carrying a knife, being stabbed with a knife. It is all a chain of events that people are not opening their eyes up to. They just think it's young boys, white, black, you know, that are carrying knives and selling drugs and they're on the corner. No, it's not. It's a private educated kid that's got a middle class background, middle upper class background, that's carrying a knife.
Yeah. You know, and no one's turning around to these kids and going, well, what's actually going on inside? Yeah. You know, it's that, are you sad because, you know, your dad hasn't given you a hug? And it sounds like something really simple and a bit almost cliche.
That's a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a lot.
And it's cliche for a reason, you know, because these cliches all become, they are a thing, and that's sort of why they're a cliche. And it's like, who is turning around to them and talking to them and sort of trying to unpick this? Who is going, why are you doing so many drugs? Like, just stop. What's happening underneath the surface? Are you depressed? Is this happening? You know, and it is that, it takes so little to end up to make such a big thing over time, you know. And it's you know, with someone saying, do you want to come to a meeting with me, that made me go, okay, I'll come to a meeting.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one person being kind that made me go, okay, yeah. And, it, you know, it's one person going, do you want to give me that knife so that you don't have to carry it
anymore? Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah. it's these small moments of kindness that don't have to be small. We can all do them as well. You know, we're not an elite just sitting here.
Everybody needs that one person to help keep you on track.
Yeah.
Just that one, but it could be a stranger.
Yeah.
It could be a nobody, you know. It just needs that one person just to show you the right way, and it can truly make a difference. Yeah. So my message out there is, it doesn't matter where you come from, what you do, how you got there. We are all affected by everything in this story today. Knife, drugs, drink. You know, loneliness, bullying, being a bully. We're all affected by it. And it's all happened to us. It doesn't matter what class of living you are. It happens. And it's happening right now. It's happening, like, to someone you love. You're doing it to someone you don't know, you know. It's a sad state of affair that people are not opening their eyes enough to see this and to move forward to make the difference. Yeah. But thankfully, we've got people like you, myself, Jamie, my team, your team, that are really making headway for small changes, which end up being big in the long run. So more people need to stand up and see, you know. And it's always easy to judge someone on the 150 million things they've done wrong, but it's really hard for people to see the one good thing that you do and that you're dedicated and focused to. So, you know, everyone's got a past. Everyone has done something wrong and wish that could just be forgotten about. And I think people need to open their eyes up a little bit more to acceptance and it's change.
It's stuff as simple as someone the other day said, why are you giving that homeless man £5?
He's only going to go and buy drugs with it.
That means that he's going to be able to have the money to go buy drugs, and he might not stab someone tonight, or he might not break in somewhere to rob something.
It's the same with, like I'm not saying littering's great, but I'm saying, like, you know, you know, if there is litter on the floor, someone has a job. It's not replaced by a machine. Someone's got a job. And I'm definitely not saying go fly tipping, you know. But
it took me, you know, I had a fiver in my pocket and I gave it to him. And that might be someone that doesn't get stabbed tonight.
Yeah.
And it's that simple, you know, he is going to have the money to go buy drugs and he might not want to kill himself for an extra day.
Mm.
And I'm not saying that I'm one to perpetuate that. But he's not going to give up until he wants to.
And you're definitely going to get negative feedback on that thing, but also positive.
He might not do something that, you know, he might not break my friend's shop front. He might not.
Someone's car window.
He might not smash someone in, and he might not hurt himself. And that's sort of that thing where it's like, it just takes a pound. And that's a little change that we've made for the better.
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff for the homeless within my community. I totally agree with you on that one.
But, you know, it's something as small as giving a pound, having a conversation with someone, asking someone how they're feeling, not are they all right. You know, it's really small changes like that, because we all reply to, you're right, yeah, mate. But how are you feeling carries us so much more weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, have a conversation with someone about how bad they're feeling. Tell a guy it's okay to cry and be there when he cries and not act weird. You know, and it's small things like that that can mean so much in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
And that's it.
I agree.
Non-judgmental, open-mindedness the whole way.
So if anyone needed to, your help, your advice on where to go, what meetings to go to, how would they go about contacting you?
I'm going to leave some CA cards here.
Yeah.
To keep. That's got a helpline on if anyone needs help in the moment. You can call them up and they'll help with that. You've got my phone number. I'm on Instagram, Henry Inked with two eyes.
Henry Inked with two eyes. Yeah, we'll add your stuff at the end of this as well.
And yeah, like if you see me, I'm always willing to talk. You can even come shout at me. I'm willing to listen to you.
Yeah.
I've got an amends to make for somebody along there somewhere who I should probably take some abuse for. But you know, it's as simple as that.
If I ever need a spot to come down and you need a safe place to meet rather than just out in public, you're more than welcome to meet them down here.
But it is that simple, you know. If you want to talk to me, I'm here and I'm ready to talk. I'm not hard to find.
Yeah, so I'll put all your details in.
All of them, address, everything.
Your private number.
But yeah, it is that simple, you know. If you want my number, you can have it. If you're struggling with addiction, you know, I'll give you numbers of all the anonymous groups. Get in touch with them, search them on the internet. There are meetings everywhere. If you really need one, then just type in, I need a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, I need Narcotics Anonymous.
But you've got to want it. You've got to want it for it to work.
And if you're doing it for someone else, it's not going to work, because that person might leave your life. And then, you know.
You'll go straight back to where you was,
But if you really want it, call me up, talk to me. Yeah, talk to me.
That's brilliant, man. Your journey's been powerful. Your story you shared with us today has been, I'll take my hat off to you, you know, you're fighting strong, you're still going for it, even though you're suffering still in some aspects of addiction, you're just replacing it with more positive addictions than negative. And that's never going to stop, that's never going to slow down, but you've got to keep working on that on a daily basis. And I think like those that are trying to get clean from this need to understand that they can't just go for the day and come out and they're clean and they will never touch it again. It's something that you'll have to work on for the rest of your life.
It's a daily thing.
Yeah. And I've got nothing but respect for you, Henry, mate. And thanks. And I hope that people understand this message, and the people that don't think this has an effect of knife crime, I think after hearing this message, I'm sure that they will see that the way that you lived your life led you to where you could have almost made some serious mistakes and been in prison for life, and you've come out on top, and now you're here to help fight for people to be in the same position you are today, and that's clean and healthy, and stronger than what you was yesterday.
Next week I'm 3 years clean and sober.
Next week, 3 years clean and sober.
Wednesday.
Absolutely.
And you know, I wouldn't have wanted to be anywhere else to sort of celebrate that and share with you, because I respect you and everything you tried to do. You know, it's the same with me. I've tried to correct the wrongs of my past and try to use my experience to help other people, and you're doing that same. You know, experience is the best thing that we can do to teach people.
Yeah, and do you know what it is? Even with my journey, like throughout my stories and my pods that I've done on myself, I the people that I have hurt in the past physically and emotionally, I'm not saying that half of them didn't deserve what happened, but I am sorry for it. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm at myself now. I'm at one with myself where I can pull back and go, maybe I could have handled that different.
Yeah.
Yes, I did what I did. You did get hurt. I am sorry for it. I'll take my hands up. I am sorry, even if I wasn't in the wrong. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, and for me that was an eye opener for me. And I'm sure that if you've had your wrongs, your sorries are there too.
Yeah.
Because we understand where we went wrong. Yeah. And that's how come our journey is clearer in our heads physically, and our movement pushing forward. It's because we understand where we went wrong, and we could have dealt with situations differently. And apologies from my behalf to the people that I have hurt.
But you know, we wouldn't have ended up here if not.
Exactly.
And I'm willing to make an amends for anything I've done in the past, but it all led me to this point.
I'm
happy with that. So
3 years clean. Yeah. Oh, well done, mate. Okay. Absolutely well done. Let's have a drink. Yeah, no, I'm joking. No, but seriously, like all jokes aside, though, man, like,
I can have that joke with you.
Yeah.
Because we're friends. So I know how it is with me and you, but like, you know, that wasn't let's go and have a drink. Like, let's have a cup of tea.
Yeah. I love cup of tea. I love one of your cup of teas.
Well, I love it. But yes, thanks again, mate, and
it was lovely being here.
Yeah, brilliant.